This is the United States Dressage Federation's official podcast. Hello and welcome to this week's episode. I'm Chris Stafford. On the show today, we have the concluding part in our four-part series on performance horse nutrition. We also have a tip from Sarah Geike. But first, the USDF would like to remind you to think about those who make every competition more special and nominate them now for recognition. Those nominations for the Regional GMO Volunteer of the Year Award, the USDF Volunteer of the Year Award, and Youth Volunteer of the Year Award are all due on August 31st. The nominations for the USEF Youth Sportsman's Award are due on September 1st. And for more information on those nominations and the process, please go to the website at usdf.org. And now joining us again for our tip of the week is Sarah Geike.
Thank you very much, Chris. It's a pleasure to be here. I love listening to all of the different people that you have on the show. It's very, very educational.
But you contribute to that education, of course, with your tips. And this week we're going to be talking about how to successfully warm up your horse at a horse show, because we know there's many aspects to that that you maybe don't always account for when you attend a show. You've got, you know, your competition nerves and everything else that's going on, as well as your performance, haven't you?
Yes, absolutely. And I'll tell you, the reason I came up with this topic was really the courtesy of one of my students at home, who is a dressage rider. She rides at Fourth Level in Pre-St. George, but she's also a hunter rider. And we got talking about how to warm her dressage horse up at the show. And I was asking her questions, how long, what do you do, what's your goal in the warm-up? And basically, the conversation went that such that she, her answer to my questions was that she was at a loss of how to warm a horse up successfully. And so I said, well, what do you do when you go to the hunter shows? And then it was like a light bulb switched on in her head, and she said, well, when I warm up at the hunter shows, I know exactly what I'm going to do. I have a formula. I have a plan. So, of course, me, I said, oh, well, then we need to do the exact same thing and get it in writing for how you warm your dressage horse up at the shows. So that's really got me thinking a lot, as well as, you know, my other students who I help with warm-ups. And then when I'm judging at shows, you inadvertently end up seeing people peripherally warming up, either effectively or ineffectively. So I thought this might be a good topic to share, but really it's courtesy of my student Marianne that got me really focused on this.
Well, it is about having a plan, isn't it? Coming well prepared.
It's completely about that. And you're totally right, Chris. And the issues at the horse shows is time management. We're nervous. You have a short period of time to warm your horse up and get him to peak so that he goes in and does the best test of his life, which is what we all hope. Oftentimes at horse shows, you're not warming up in a nice, enclosed, logical area, but you're warming up in the wide open spaces with anywhere from 10 to 50 other people. So it can be very challenging. So having a plan in your mind can really help to alleviate a lot of the show nerves and a lot of those situations that I just mentioned. So what I recommend to people, and I do this with most of my students at home too, when they get ready for the show, is that they have a plan. They write it down. Okay, they first decide, okay, I'm going to warm my horse up for X amount of minutes. And they start mathematically. They know that they're going to ride their test at 4 o'clock. And say, for example, they want to do a 30-minute warm-up. Okay, right off the bat, 10 minutes of that is going to be free walk long rein. So that's going to leave them 20 minutes left. They have 10 minutes for a warm-up. And then they have the last 10 minutes where they're going to do their finished warming-up to get the horse peaking and ready to go in and do the test. So that's just an example of what I encourage people to really think about doing in their warm-up. So just some thoughts for how to determine what is the best approach for each person's individual horse, because they're all different. And, of course, you have to know your horse. You know what kind he is. Is he hot? Is he lazy? Have an idea of what time frame is good for him. Particularly in summer heat, most horses benefit by a short, effective warm-up. And when I say effective, what I mean is you have to be super good at time management, which is a lot of what this is about. And second, you have to be effective in your riding instead of just meandering around doing this, that, and the other thing. So in the first phase of your warm-up at the show, our goal is first to get the horse physically and mentally attentive on the aids, in front of the leg, in front of the seat, consistently connected into the contact and into the bridle. And then, in addition, our goal is to get the horse supple and loose. And there's two elements of that. We have the lateral suppleness, like bending and circles and shoulder ends, and then we have the longitudinal suppleness, half halts, transitions through the gate, that approach. So we have to make a decision on, in this initial warm-up, what works best for our horse, the longitudinal suppleness, lateral suppleness exercises, or is it a combination of both? So that's what I encourage people to start to think of and to really formulate a plan in their mind for exactly what exercises they're going to do with their horse in the initial phase of the warm-up, the first 10 minutes. Once they've done their initial warm-up, they take a short break, and then they'll do the second piece of their warm-up where they can begin to ask more of the horse. If it's a higher level, here you'd ask for more collection. If it's a lower level, you'd ask for more connection and throughness and increased suppleness. Often at a horse show, in the second phase of the warm-up, you end up warming up by doing bits and pieces of the test, some of the test movements to use to increase the collection and to increase the suppleness. And that also helps the rider's nerves because then they feel a little bit at ease, like, okay, I know this is going to work. I know that's going to work. But that being said, I would discourage people from feeling like they have to ride the whole test in the warm-up before they go in to do the competition. Because we've all heard that saying, well, I won the warm-up. And then you go in the arena and it's all gone. So, that's essentially what I would really encourage people to do, is to figure out what exercises, figure out your time frame, and really write it down and have a plan that you're going to do this, and this, and then you go in and you do your test. You can also take it a little step farther and think that when it is your turn to do your test in the show, what is your plan when you're riding around the outside of the arena before the judge rings the bell? What's the most beneficial for your horse? Some horses, it's walking if they're nervous. Horses that are get behind the aids and they go in that environment and they start to suck back and not go forward, you might do medium trots or medium trot collective. You might do extended canter, for example. Horses that tend to stiffen up from their nerves might benefit from more shoulder in, half pass type work. So all things to think about so that when you do to make that turn at A and go down center line, your goal is to have as much horse with you as possible. I mean, really, for showing, everybody's objective is to train and ride the horse so that they understand to stay on the aids for the whole test. That would be the ultimate, because if that happened, the horse would be rideable, you'd have control over the movements, you would be able to present the picture of relaxation and harmony, and you'd make it look easy. And that's really what it's all about. And of course, the other aspect, which is having fun.
Yes. So lots to think about there. And of course, if you're an amateur, you maybe don't get that amount of practice. So it's often a good idea to go along to shows anyway, to watch other people and see how they prepare too, isn't it? Just get immersed in it as much as possible so you get comfortable with the environment and not worry so much about that as your performance.
Yeah, that's a, you're so right, Chris. You're so right. And then in addition to that, I would also want to stress that the warm-up at a horse show shouldn't really be different from the warm-up that you do at home. It should, they should follow each other, albeit when you're at a horse show, it's going to be a condensed version. It's going to be shorter than perhaps what you do at home. But they should be very, very similar. And by doing it that way, that is a powerful tool to help your horse relax and to put him at ease. So that when you go to a horse show, if he's nervous and he's wondering, well, what are we doing, what are we doing? And you start warming up and you follow your normal plan, he will automatically go, oh, okay, we're just doing this. And they breathe and they start to relax. So happy showing, everybody.
Well, thank you very much indeed, Sarah, for that. We always appreciate your input. Thank you for your time coming on the program.
Okay. Thank you very much for having me, Chris.
And now for our final segment in the four-part series on performance horse nutrition that was recorded at the education session at the 2014 Adequan USDF Annual Convention by Donald R. Kappa. In this segment, he discusses feeding for the job.
Everybody's feed must have a purpose statement on it. And so make sure that you read this purpose statement and it fits into your what you're doing with the horse. And I just copied four of them down here randomly. This one says, horses of all ages eating grass or mixed forages. So you know the percentages of nutrients are going to be pretty high if you can do that in here, like a diet balancer. This one for growing, reproducing, and performing as well as idle. So this is probably going to be one for mares and foals. But you can feed it to idle horses if you need that many calories. For mature idle horses or maintenance, this is your 10% protein, some 12% protein feeds. When it says this, don't feed it to your performance horse. It will not meet his needs. They're telling you up front it won't. So be an educated consumer. Read the purpose of it. And if it says for performance horses, then it's safe for you to feed your performance horse. But when I get called out on a consulting basis and I have problems on our high-end horses, they're usually feeding something like this because it's the cheapest feed they could buy per bag. But it doesn't meet the horse's nutrient needs. So read the feeding directions and buy those that meet your horses. Now this is just for an example. The premium line, you can feed them on, find them on texturized or pelleted grains. But the purpose statement will list right on it. The mare and foal is for growing and reproducing. Performance feed is for the performance horse at all levels. Original is a low non-structure carbohydrate pelleted feed. Senior feed is for older horses that have difficulty chewing, or if you don't have adequate hay supply, it can act as a hay substitute also. But it'll tell you all this. What impact does amino acids have on the muscle after the work? For recovery during exercise, we're looking at the milk-based amino acids to provide a faster recovery. Timing is very important when you're doing this, and it's ideal if you can get these milk-based amino acids into them before 45 minutes when you're done working. A little goes a long way, and here I have an example for humans. How many of you know people that work out with weights are, and as soon as they're done, they reach for their protein shake? This is just one of those protein shakes on the market called MyoPlex. And MyoPlex has 25 grams of protein in a bottle. And so one of these bottles is recommended for every 200 pounds of body weight. Or 13 grams, or half a bottle, for 100-pound body weight for humans. So on a horse, on 1,100-pound horses, they will need 138 grams of milk protein. That's 8 ounces or 2 enclosed cups of Topline Extreme, and that comes in a bucket. What it is pelletized whey protein concentrate plus added amino acids, strictly amino acids. And we can get this much into them shortly after work, and you'll be amazed at how fast they'll bounce back after intense work. So a well-balanced diet includes good quality forage and a feed, a diet balancer, or a grain mixture to complement your forage and meet your horse's needs. But it also means including electrolytes and amino acids within 45 minutes after they're done working. Bottom line is, what is the net balance after work? When you're just feeding high levels of grain, the horse is going to lose body weight and muscle mass. In a net balance in the negative, by balancing the diet, we're going to see a big improvement on net balance. By adding the milk-based amino acids afterwards, we're even going to see a better response. If you're feeding a feed less pounds per day than what the feed manufacturer recommends, then you can continue feeding that, but I'm going to recommend going to a ultra-concentrated feed with milk-based formula, and you can top-dress that on top, because it not only is high amino acids, but it has the minerals and vitamins in it that you'll be missing if you're feeding less feed per day than that manufacturer recommends. So read the feed tag and know what the minimum amount is of the feed you're feeding. Electrolytes, how does that impact on supporting muscle after workout? You know, what are they? What do they do? How much should really be given per day is a big variable. So, but when horses sweat, they lose water and the electrolytes, or the salts in their body. Dehydration can cause a decrease in performance, faster fatigue, muscle cramping, and other heat-related performance problems. So we have to maintain our fluid and electrolyte balance every day. So the work that I'm presenting here, I spent 3.5 years in conjunction at the University of Guelph in Canada, working with this, and we published this in the Journal of Exercise Physiology. And so if you feed the aquate electrolyte as we recommend, we can delay the onset of fatigue by over 22%. Now, I compare that to what is currently done in the human, and when human athletes are used and given electrolytes adequately, it will delay the onset of fatigue by 25%. So we're pretty close to ideal based on if 25% to humans is ideal. It'll reduce the incidence of muscle cramping, and it'll improve the horse's ability to perform at that same high level the very next day. So how much should be given per day? There's varying amounts. So if they're idle and sweating or traveling and in light work, you can top dress the electrolyte on the feed as long as you have plenty of water to drink. But just remember, all electrolytes are hydroscopic. That means if they don't have water to drink, they will pull water from their body, put it into their digestive system to break it down. If they have water to drink, the sodium level in there will cause them to drink more water, and that's exactly what they need to break it down so it can be absorbed easily. I say that because when you're giving a paste electrolyte, and we followed paste electrolytes through the stomach and the small intestine and timed how fast they were broken down, all paste electrolytes dehydrate the horse because all of them lay in the gut and pull water from the body until it's broken down, and then it'll be reabsorbed. So any research paper I've read on paste electrolytes always do an analysis of electrolytes on the horse 1 hour after they give the electrolyte. So when your horses are in moderate to intense work, these are the upper level and FEI horses, we recommend mixing it in water and make an AquaAid solution and offer that within 45 minutes when they're cooling down. And so an AquaAid solution is 4 ounces of our electrolyte per gallon of water. When we were at the 100-day stallion test, I gave this to the Germans that were in charge of running it, and they say, oh, we tried that, it doesn't work. And I said, well, appease me. I said, just try it and let me know what happens. And I went back the next weekend, and they said, what's in that? He said, the horses have regular water in front of them, but when we put them in their stall and we give them the electrolyte mixture, if we're too late, they just bang and bang and bang that stall door. Although water is there, they want the electrolyte. We work very hard at making this palatable, and so it'll work, so it will not dehydrate the horse. So the number of ounces to feed per day will depend on their workload for the day, light, moderate, or intense, and the stress index of the day. An example is the degrees in Fahrenheit plus the percent humidity. At the 1996 Olympic Games in Atlanta. And this is the electrolyte we used in the veterinary tent. We didn't have one problem that year But there was a lot of things, a lot of people working at it to make sure that every horse's needs were met. So we want to add the degrees together for the day, and that is called the heat stress index. If the heat stress index is between 140 and 160, all right, then it'll take more electrolytes to meet their losses. And in the heat stress of over 160, which is almost every day, this is where we're looking at 3 ounces a day for light work, 6 for moderate, and 9 ounces a day for those FEI horses. Too many people don't know this. It's been published, but too many people don't know, and that's why we're here to explain, to help you keep your horses healthy and keep them being able to perform. Good? Had a few questions? Yeah. The question was, what about the top line, comparing it to a young horse to an older horse? And as horses age, their ability to absorb protein and phosphorus diminish. So the first thing that we see is a weakened top line muscle and a sagging back. There's nothing we can do to prevent that. We want to slow it down as much as possible. But no, that's the aging process. Yeah, good question. Wow, what do we recommend for horses that don't sweat? We don't know the answer to that. Right? The people that did the work on that from Sarah Ralston at Rutgers and also in conjunction with the University of Florida came up with a product called 1AC. That's probably the best one on the market, and I would say it works 70% of the time. But there's a lot more work. We're doing some work right now on the what can we do to control internal temperature, core temperature. The work that was done on dairy cattle was very effective. They were able to keep core body temperatures down between 1.5 and 2 degrees when they did this. And so we are now trying that on horses. That'll be a year or so. Until that's out. But it's very frustrating. Right now, the only thing we can do is ship them north into cooler temperatures or put them into air-conditioned stalls. That will do the trick, too.
Thanks again to Donald Kappa for this presentation. And you can find the previous parts to this, numbers 1 through 3, on the last 3 weeks' podcasts. There's also an accompanying article in the May edition of the USDF Connection magazine. And a reminder that this podcast is available for download from the iTunes podcast store to your smartphone or tablet app, such as Podbean or Stitcher, so you can listen to the show on the go, like so many of you do around the world, and we appreciate your support. Be sure to check out eTrack on the USDF.org website for more educational resources and also for accompanying topics that we do here on the podcast. Until next week, thanks again for listening, and don't forget that the USDF is your connection to the American dressage community.